Well, of course, I wrote this before I heard what they had to say, but I'm afraid I couldn't even begin to address all the lovely points they made. I dispute some of them, but what you're going to find that I'm going to read is actually what I'm going to read is proof of what they have said. This is one more little thumb on the scale of collegiality. And it might be boring a little bit, but it's short. I want to thank the panelists for coming here and being very kind about my work. I figured they would be. I can easily return this favor, as I have been motivated and inspired by each. When I first met Gary Cates in the basement of the BN, he had a full beard, looked like a college undergraduate, and had an undying interest in the press, a mutual focus. Excuse me. Jeremy and I likewise have always been extremely close, and we have shared each other's work, and now into our fifth decade of mutual interest in the subject. We've been described by Frenchmen as, are you guys twins or something? But you don't look the same. Lynn and Tim and I met about the same time. Although they have the same mentor, I borrowed very differently from them. Trained as a social historian myself, I could see that Tim had extended its range, the range of social history, incredibly. When he took a job at Catholic, he, more than anyone else, worked to build an amazing shared intellectual community in the Baltimore, Washington area in pursuit of knowledge on the old regime and French Revolution. What conversations we had. Also, impromptu in the Library of Congress, which was so important in the pre-internet age. And what a local group we had, with numerous outstanding scholars who are always there for advice, help, and intellectual stimulation. And finally, Lynn Hunt has been an inspiration, as she provided a model for moving social history presciently, with great vision, into the paradigm of cultural history. I have been so lucky to have received an early push in that direction. Collaborating with her in, I think, three projects, I mean, iterations of two of them, collaborating with her opened me to the advantages available from visual sources. So many others, I want to reference them now too, so many others who have made this career meaningful, and too many to begin to name, so many others I want to credit. But very quickly, Lenny Berlinstein was my fraternal twin brother at Hopkins and later lived in D.C., though commuting to Charlottesville. He read almost every word that I wrote, from early chapters of my dissertation to the last stuff before his untimely death a few years ago. And then there was my mentor, Robert Forster, who patiently put up with me as I transferred my undergraduate interest in the Russian Revolution, which uses a funny language, to the French Revolution of 1789. I do have to, an anecdote popped in my head when Tim was talking about Prelude to Power. He did say to me, however, he's a social historian, he said, Jack, please count something. And if you look at the book, I did. It's a whole chapter full of content analysis. And many thanks to my second reader, Orest Ranum, an early entrant into cultural history who guided me in that direction. George Mason University proved to be a happy home. When Roy Rosenzweig joined the faculty, the digital age for historians had not begun. But Roy was one of the earliest and most important adoptees. Without Roy and Lynn, there would have been no Liberty, Equality, and Fraternity, the website that Lynn and I created. Certainly, not least or last, was Mac Holt, I'll get you later, who joined the history department decades ago and who, with others, created a force field of interest in the old regime study group that sustained me, as I mentioned, many others. And now Christy Picaro is a recent but much appreciated colleague. And I can't close without thanking Jane Turner Censor, who started graduate school, as was reported somewhat salaciously, who started graduate school as I finished. She, too, read all my drafts and listened to my unformed ideas as well. In her case, I did reciprocate and also did something that she did not interest her at all, and that was I'm the cook. Beyond the encouragement and aid of particular individuals has been the rigor and demands of the field of French history, which has been a leader in scholarship and has provided challenges and guidance. I think you know what I mean. Alongside the competitive spirit which pushes us to do better and think harder lies a larger community in which not only challenge but also support is always available. I remember clearly how alone I felt at my first SFHS in Ottawa in 1972 when I knew absolutely no one. But the embrace of a shared enterprise drew me in and has helped and supported me to this day. Praise the bridge that carries you over. That's what kept coming to my mind. And it has characterized this profession, my career, helped my work, given a community of support and stimulation that has meant so very much that no matter how crazy our nation or my university has been, there always has been a band of sisters and brothers to lean upon. Thank you.
What's it, Butler University? And I've known Jack for 40 years or so, somewhere in there. And I'll just give one word, which Jeremy already mentioned, which is generous. I think Jack is among the most generous of the colleagues I've enjoyed working with all these many decades. I gave my first paper at the Western Society in Greeley in 1981, as I recall, 81, 82, right in there. And Jack came up after that session to console me. Because Robert Forster gave the comment. And he thought I probably needed some picking up after being picked apart by his mentor. I thought to myself, that's exactly what Robert Forster was going to say. It was no surprise, but it was very nice of Jack to do that. In those days, I was teaching at Arizona State University, and while I was there, drove down the freeway to chat and have lunch with Bill Sewell, who's not here this weekend. But Bill then described Jack to me as the official greeter in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And I think that certainly fits. And as I look around this room, I suspect I could probably make a list of at least half of us who I've looked across hotel breakfast rooms at over the years and seen Jack sitting with, offering some advice and some encouragement to junior scholars who have all benefited from your help and your support, Jack. So thanks for that.
I'm Karen Offen, and I wanted to say a little something more about the series which was mentioned just at the end of the comments, Rewriting History, which is a magnificent series of work on the historiography, really, of many different subjects that Routledge published, and Jack was the chief operator on the series. I want to add one word to the list of words that describes Jack, and this may not be a characteristic word, patience. he had asked me to edit the volume on globalizing feminisms to supplement the volume that Bonnie Smith had done, and it took 10 years to produce it. And Jack was very patient, and he kept encouraging. He said, well, how about, you know, next year? And we kept at this. Finally, it got done. And I think it was worth the wait because it's got full of world-class articles on this subject. And Jack, I want to thank you for that. But also, thank you for that patience and the encouragement and all the good work you've done.
So, I'm Lloyd Kramer from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and I can't remember exactly the moment I met Jack, but I do remember an early conversation in Paris at the Bibliothèque Nationale and having lunch in the Palais Royal, one of those restaurants with Nancy Green, and how enthusiastic you were. And, you know, academics often tend to be kind of introverted. You know, I think on a Myers-Briggs exam or whatever, you probably scored E, I don't know, but he was so energetic and enthusiastic, and I can't thank him enough for all the great meals and conversations and stories we've shared and laughter. I want to just put laughter. That would be one word that hasn't come up, but I want to mention one other aspect to Jack's career that's been mentioned partly by Christy, his role as a leader, but among the many conversations we've had, I remember when I was chair of my department and having a couple of long conversations with Jack about the role of administrative leadership in a university. And what he helped me to think about was how that too is a sphere for creative intellectual work. That when early in my career, like everybody, I think, oh, who would ever want to play that kind of role? That's just dead end. And I thought Jack had a vision as both department chair and as a dean for how this can be a way in which our skills as historians, as researchers, as writers, as interlocutors, as visionaries can make a difference in the communities we live in. And I want to thank you for that, because it helped me at a critical moment when I was taking on more leadership roles. And I just, my final thought, there's so much we could also talk about in terms of encouraging intellectually my work. But I feel like the way to describe Jack is really with a Beatles song. And no one has brought up the Beatles. Because what do they have to do with French history? But I want to say that when I think of Jack, you know the famous song, "And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make," or something like that. You give. No, I think it's make and take. I mean, it rhymes. I'm no musician. But I want to thank Jack for making a community of people, and I hope today you feel that you are taking back what you've helped to create. Merci beaucoup, mon ami.
In or out of tune?
May I?
Oui.
Okay, thank you. Hi, my name is Elizabeth Andrews Bond. I'm at Ohio State. I just wanted to thank Jack for being one of the earliest readers of my work. We met many years ago at the Consortium on for the Revolutionary Era, and you offered really helpful early feedback as I was beginning to think about doing a history of the press. So I just wanted to thank you for your support, for your encouragement, for your criticism, and for reading the work at that early stage, and then the dissertation. It's meant a lot. So, thank you.
Hi, John Harvey, St. Cloud State. I don't have a direct association with George Mason, and of course I'm not from the generation of all of his friends and fellows who have spoken, but I have been interviewing a lot of historians, as everyone knows. And one of the things that really is interesting is that this is a generation that came forward from 65 to about the mid to late 70s, and the intellectual firepower that came out in that decade really has been difficult to see ever again in terms of the old versus the new. And you could say that there were other countries that had that kind of generational explosion of interest. But the point that Lynn made about sociability and friendship, that may be rather peculiar to America. And the five of you being great friends, being colleagues through thick and thin, I don't know if you could go elsewhere and see that as easily, particularly coming out of that dynamic period of the late 60s to 70s, particularly from coming back from different institutions. Stanford and Johns Hopkins weren't the same. So as someone who's younger and not a part of your generation and not directly connected, I can just say that as a witness, I appreciate, Jack, both your capacity as a personal leader amongst that group, and look, the model that the five of you and the rest have given for us younger folks, especially in the trying times that we have today.
Well,
I don't know who learned from who, but I do want to say that this is a very competitive group, and we're all very competitive. But I do think we did share this vision that we could stand back. We could let somebody else shine. And I do think we also had in the back of our minds, and these are some of my closest friends in the world, in the back of our minds, make sure you have thought about how you want this thing to come out. Not right now, but a month from now, a year from now. And I think that helped us. We wanted to come out as advancing scholarship, advancing the teaching, advancing knowledge in history, and no one was going. I mean, there's plenty of room for lots of people, and I do think I felt, oh my gosh, intimidated. I felt competitive. I felt all that stuff, but it wasn't worth joining a fray. It was worth joining up, and I've co-authored. Not you, right? Everybody else. I've co-authored with everybody else. And believe me, it's as far as I'm concerned, it's always a supplement. It's always a supplement. It's always a plus. And so I think, I'm not so sure it's a generational thing. I think it might have been coming out of the 60s the way we were, all of us. Gary was the 40s, I believe. No. Yeah. He's the kid. So I just couldn't help but respond to that. And maybe anybody, Christy.
And I think so many of us are so embattled right now in our departments and in our discipline. And I'm wondering if any of you have words of wisdom for us going forward in an inhospitable environment that we find ourselves in.
Well, I want to say more than one thing that's come to my mind since we have a little bit of time. I'm not sure we were maybe students in the 60s, but I really think it's actually a generation of the 70s, when the supposed job crisis had actually already begun about that time. But I think one advantage that we did have over the current situation was, and one reason it was possible and even would have been stupid not to take the position that there was enough to go around. In other words, it wasn't a zero-sum game. It wasn't, if you got something, then somebody else wasn't going to get it. Oh, of course, there was some of that. There inevitably is. But we all had jobs. So there was a way in which everyone could prosper. And I think there's a...
Well,
I think
if I can just break in, yes. We are members of the one-third of PhDs produced in the 70s,
yes,
who did get,
yes,
jobs.
Yes, but we are the ones who did get academic jobs. Right. It's true. But so once you did have a job,
yes,
it was possible to have the feeling that first of all, it was already a time when things were more fixed. It wasn't going to be that easy to move. So things like French historical studies and the Western society were incredibly important as times, and the Bibliothèque Nationale, and then the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, even, at Tolbiac, were very important ways to be supportive in a more general way, because it wasn't going to be easy. But if you had the camaraderie and you had the chances to go to France to do research, it was still in our generation possible. You know, you could do things. You could do research. You could write books, and you didn't have to feel embattled all the time. I don't think you'd want to be an administrator if you had felt embattled all the time. So I do think the current situation is perhaps right now more difficult, but I think it means it's even more important to have these kinds of situations where people can exchange ideas. The most important thing in feeling embattled is to have support, to figure out what are you doing at your place, what are the kinds of issues that are being faced. Each institution has a slightly different situation. UCLA, for example, has just combined French, Italian, German, and Scandinavian, but not Slavic or Spanish and Portuguese. And so there are all kinds of things happening, and people need to exchange views on, well, why does your school doing that, and why are we doing what we're doing? So I think in that sense, sociability is still the crucial element for moving forward. We don't know what the future is going to bring. I would love to be able to say that everything is going to get better eventually. We've said the job crisis was going to go away at some point, and it never did. So I think it's really important to exchange views.
And I think the centrality of Paris as a place to do research allows us, it's not just three times
right.
we meet.
Right,
it's
exactly.
It's over and over and over right. again, and a great place to break bread and go to museums.
Precisely.
The things that were important in the career of our generation, I guess it was Tim who mentioned the Bicentennial Congress in Paris, and we did have the extraordinary good fortune to be working on the history of the French Revolution at a moment when there were opportunities and interest in the subject that were unequaled and are not likely to come again in our active lifetimes. The number of places in which Jack and I spoke on the French Revolutionary Press in the decade of the 1980s, I can't even begin to remember all of them. Vizille, certainly, in that hair-rising ride in the bus up and down the mountain every morning.
Great, Joel. We wouldn't be here.
Bielefeld in Germany, Haifa in Israel, where they were forcing us to drink a liter of water every half an hour so we wouldn't pass out from dehydration in their unair-conditioned university building. It was an extraordinary moment in which you had the opportunity to talk about your own research on the subject and hear all the other leading scholars from around the world and exchange ideas with them. And something similar has happened in recent years for the scholars who work on the history of the First World War, for example. But that was a defining period for my career, and I think for yours.
Do you remember when we walked up together and met Pierre Etat, who was the consigliere of History of the Press?
Yeah.
We walked up, and this is 1989, I'm 43 years old, and he says to me, you're about 41. And he says to us, he said, I've read your work. You're so young. I thought that was great. I didn't think I was young anymore. Now that you're 43 and I'm not, I see how young.
Yes. Would you identify yourself, you who asked such a powerful question about,
I'm Nicole Hutchins, and I teach history at the University of Baltimore.
Great. Mm-hmm. Nicole, I'm so struck by what you said because I think we all feel a certain pessimism like you're talking about and that this is a crisis point, but we may all feel it for different reasons and it may be expressed on our campuses very different. For me, I would mention two reasons why I feel this is a crisis with headwinds. One is the recentering of European history within the history curriculum and faculties on almost all of our campuses. When Bill Sewell in 1975 gave a talk to those of us who were first-year graduate students at the University of Chicago, he made us feel like having gone into European history, we were absolutely champions. We were like going to change the field of history. And we felt that sense. And seeing the way that European history has been recentered is both, I think we all would admit, a very good thing for history, but a difficult thing for historians of France. It's just a difficult transition for us. But one of the outer reasons that makes it even more difficult is the recentering of history and the humanities within the curriculum and faculties on our campuses. And that, too, it's a wonderful thing that on my campus, women are flooding into computer science. And what's happened in the way the sciences have occupied a more central place in the liberal arts is only to be applauded as far as I'm concerned. But it's a very difficult transition for us to manage. And I say that both as a history professor and as a former dean. So I think those are the headwinds that I see us wrestling with.
I think many of us have a sense that the headwinds are even more dangerous than that. In the 70s, there was a terrible job crisis for people trying to start academic careers. But I don't think you could really talk about a crisis of universities. There had been a period of tremendous expansion of American higher education in the late 50s and 60s, and that had abruptly come to a stop. But universities themselves were, I think, still generally regarded as essential institutions for society. And I think we really worry at the moment that the climate has changed in some really radical way, that there is a hostility to the whole notion of higher education, and especially humanities education. And there is also an alarming restructuring of what it means to be a teacher at the university level, and I'm sure I don't have to tell any of you the increasing number of adjuncts, the sense that the tenure track positions that all of us have enjoyed may not be there in the future. I said to Lynn, we have to remember that only a minority of the PhDs in our cohort ever got academic jobs at all, but those of us who did got really good jobs, and that's why we're still here today. And now there's a real question about what kind of employment is going to be available for young people just as talented as we were trying to go into the profession.
I don't think we should end on a pessimistic note. I don't think we should end on a pessimistic note, because I think that, you know, I think what Gary was suggesting is that the changes are happening. It remains to be seen exactly what their outcome is going to be. And I would just say, as someone who has studied the French Revolution and finds it more interesting with each passing year rather than less interesting, that it points to, I think, one of the sources of our current, this particular current dilemma. I think the problems we're facing are in part actually the unintended consequence of democratization. You democratize the university, and it means it no longer stands for elite status. Therefore, there's a kind of familiarity breeds discontent kind of reaction going on, because it's happening all over the Western world. It's not a U.S. phenomenon. The more people who have gone to university, the less it is the sort of truly valued commodity, supposedly. And yet, at the same time, as we know from the recent scandal, people are willing to pay almost unimaginable sums of money to get their kids into what they see as the true key to success. So I think it's more mixed. I don't think it's just that universities are being devalued. I think we're in a period when expertise is under question, but expertise is not going to go away. And though there is going to be questioning, I don't think it's going to end with, we're not going to trust science, we're not going to go to doctors. I think the fact is, it has to do with more of the public being engaged with these issues than ever before, which means we have a more important role than ever before in teaching people how to think through these issues. So I'm more optimistic that in the long run, democratization is not a bad thing. But it always has certain problems that come along with it that have to do with this, have to do with feminization. When more women get positions, they're less desirable. When more minorities get positions, they're less desirable. The positions are less desirable. This is just what happens, and it doesn't mean we don't want to push in that direction. It means we have to figure out how to deal with these consequences.
And one other thing, our place in the world market is enormous. I mean, Jane and I were at just a regular eatery in Fairfax, and there was this table speaking French. And I didn't know we had any connection at all to Western Europe, so I couldn't, at the end, we finished our dinner. I know Jack talks to Ed the Wall. So I said to them in Franglais, more or less, you know, to the, I mean, I was speaking English and French separately. As you know, I said that one there was a woman there was clearly the student, if there was a student. And I said, gee, why are you here in Fairfax? And she said, I'm a student at George Mason University. This was a Parisian who's doing her undergraduate work. George Mason is hardly a household word in France. And then since then, I met another French person, a French woman of color who just finished her degree. So in the unexpected markets for American universities will buoy some anyway, especially if they're in major metropolitan areas where there's a, you know, a, other people up from there, where they're from, to relate to. So, I mean, I'm kind of with you, Lynn.
Just didn't want to end on a down.
Well, all right, we won't.
French historians always end on an up note.
Up note. I have an up note.